Texas Talking Owl.
What was that that you said?
Texas Talking Owl.
Gonna hoop upside your head.
Texas Talking Owl.
Tell me, who can you trust when Texas gods are in Texas?
Hello and welcome to the Tripcast. I'm John Dickerson of the Slate Political Gabfest. The last time I was in Austin for a long time, your governor was elected president, so get ready for Governor Perry. But before that, join us Wednesday, April 23rd at the Schultz Garden for a joint Tribcast Slate Gabfest live podcast. Find out more and get tickets at www.slate.com/Austin. And now, here's your Tribcast host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week of April. We are very excited about our upcoming GabFest with Slate on the 23rd, so please come to that. In the meantime, I'm joined by executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Editor Emily Ramshaw.
Hello there.
And Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Howdy. Oh, wait a minute. That's already been said.
Ross.
Damn it. Sorry.
Try again.
It's been so
long. That's my motto, man.
Hold on. And Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Hello.
Well, that was great. I'm glad we
really innovative.
Held off for that. Well, shall we dive right in? I think we have a number of topics today, and I think our first one will be University of Texas System Regent Wallace Hall. I've read the latest report about him. Ross, you've read the latest report.
I haven't read it in the detail you have. Let's hear it. What were your favorite words from the report?
I had a list of words, but I can't pull it up really fast. So this is a report from Rusty Hardin, who is the special counsel to the Transparency Committee. It's actually the House Select Committee on Transparency and State Agency Operations. And that committee has been investigating Wallace Hall, who was a regent appointed to the University of Texas System Board of Regents back in February 2011. And his track record on the board has been controversial, to say the least. And they've been considering whether or not to recommend articles of impeachment against him. Basically, he's been conducting sort of multiple personal investigations of the UT Austin administration and costing people a lot of time and money and heartache. He says he's also uncovering serious problems at the university. But
he would not describe them as personal investigations. I mean, he would describe
investigations
into wrongdoing at the university.
No, I mean, they're investigations that he is leading and conducting.
Right, not as a...
He would describe them not on behalf
of the regents, but as a regent.
He would describe them as things that he has to do because no one else there is willing to do the politically difficult work that he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But he is doing them basically on his own. And I think he would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the lawmakers have accused him of being on a witch hunt to get rid of Bill Powers. And that's been a sort of a back and forth ongoing thing.
Right.
Or lawmakers, I guess, have also assumed that, you know, he's trying to potentially threaten them by sort of digging up dirt on, you know, how Jim Pitts's son got into law school.
That's what he has alleged. He has alleged that they're trying to cover up their sordid entanglements with the UT Austin.
And that one in itself has become one of the items that might help get him impeached, right?
Right. So Rusty Hardin, the committee special counsel, they put out his report to the committee this week. This is not the committee's final report, so we still don't know what they're going to do. But their special counsel, who basically, you know, organized the investigation for them and has compiled all their information, said that they have 4 legitimate grounds for impeachment if they decide to proceed against Hall. And what I thought was interesting about it from reading the report reading the report is interesting just because it is so colorfully worded. I think Hall is described as bullying, blustery, vindictive, malignant, and sort of at every turn, the committee is offered the opportunity to view him in the worst light. For example, you know, Hall refused to testify before the committee, so Hardin's team writes, you know, of course, it's not at all, you know, he's totally within his rights to not testify before the committee. This might be something that people do when they have something to hide. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, it goes on like this, but an example. Hall has engaged in a vindictive pattern of bullying administrators he ranks above the UT system and its component institutions. If subordinates failed to comply with his demands or if subordinates disagreed with his policy aims, he attempted to pressure those individuals to comply. Because malignant management and personal skills alone do not likely warrant legislative action, counsel also examined whether Hall's problematic conduct was directed at the best interests of the institutions he was appointed to serve. It was not.
So that gives you a good sense of the tone. But what I really thought was interesting is that a decent chunk of the things he might get impeached for. So the four things listed by Hardin as the most impeachable offenses either happened entirely or in part after or even because the committee was considering impeaching him. Yeah. So it's sort of like,
which doesn't seem
this
really
weird situation.
I mean, that doesn't exactly seem kosher to me. I mean, is that sort of feels like entrapment?
Well, Hall's not
a
Jewish.
Bit.
Yeah.
All right. Monday is Passover. Passover. Yes. I mean, but it seems to me like, you know, that's the same kind of allegations that you come under in like the To Catch a Predator show.
Well,
where,
I mean,
like,
but
were
that's
they going to commit a crime.
That's what
anyway,
Bill Clinton was impeached for.
Yeah, the Department of Pre-Crime or something like that.
Yeah, right.
Like the Minority Report.
Wasn't Clinton more or less impeached for not telling the truth in his hearings and his impeachment?
Yeah, it's your conduct, you know, while in office. And that includes conduct after the, you know, investigation of your conduct in office has begun. You know, the first rule of Hall's is stop digging, and Hall has kept digging.
Well, literally, he's kept digging. So, right. I mean, one of the things, one of the impeachable offenses is just his burdensome and endless demands for information from the UT Austin system, which have sort of overtasked their records office, and he's never really explained why he was digging into things, and it's caused a lot of problems for everyone, and the system lawyers are fighting with the university lawyers. And that was happening. That was one of the reasons that they started the impeachment investigation, but that did not stop Hall from continuing to demand that stuff. And in fact, he's still doing that to this day, even after the public hearings have ended. So he literally kept digging into the UT Austin and digging himself sort of a deeper hole with the committee, I guess.
Right.
The other one is that his handling, and sort of they frame it as pressure and manipulation and intimidation of witnesses for the committee. So President Powers from UT Austin, Chancellor Sigaroa, and UT Austin's chief financial officer all testified, and then Hall tried to pressure Chancellor Sigaroa into taking, basically, you know, either firing or reprimanding Powers and Hegarty for their
comments before
for their testimony, which Hall believed was misleading.
Right.
But the committee said, you know, you can't bully the witnesses, which goes against the UT system has a policy about not taking any action against
whistleblower policy
about whistleblowers, right. And the committee had asked them, do not take any negative employment action against anyone that's involved in our investigation. So he was pushing for that. So that might get him impeached. He might get impeached because there was this thing where the UT Austin had a disagreement with CASE, which is this national organization that sets fundraising standards. And so they had a system approved trip to talk to the people at CASE and try to work out their differences and see if they could get a policy that's workable for everyone. And for reasons that are still sort of unknown to everyone, Hall flew up to D.C. and attended this meeting and argued against UT Austin. And because the regent rules, it's sort of the code of the regents, if you will, calls for him to not publicly criticize the institutions and to do what's in their best interest.
Sort of to keep the fight at the dinner table, yeah, and don't take it outside.
Since went to publicly fight against them in D.C., they think that shows that he's sort of not competent.
What's his aim here? What's your sense of that? I mean, how does all this come out if Hall succeeds in what he's trying to do?
It's unclear because he has not been very forthcoming with his motivation, right? I mean, they've sort of put out, well, we found this stuff. And, you know, well, we've been digging and we found this stuff. And this stuff might be like, oh, an email from someone inquiring to someone else in the university about the status of Jim Pitts' son's application to the law school. Right. So he says, clearly there's like a clout scandal over there where politicians can have an open door policy. And, you know, there might be some setup where politicians can get people into the university easier than other
people. It would be
shocking,
wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Totally shocking. I mean,
but he doesn't have a bigger goal.
And he'll throw these things out, but then when he's sort of offered the opportunity to come give his side of the story off, and he hasn't taken it. So there was this whole thing, the committee refused to subpoena him and he refused to testify, but he could have come and testified. He chose to not come and testify.
Isn't there some defense for him in the idea that if he succeeds in what he's doing, that that's for the good of the institution and it's not against the – and I mean, one of the things here is he's not acting in the interest of the institution, and it seems like his best defense is, yeah, I am.
That is an argument he could make. And if he wanted to come and make that publicly, we would welcome that, I think.
But I guess without saying the I believe this is happening. I'm trying to figure this out. Then how can you say you're...
Well, and the problem is...
Maybe his lawyer's advising him not to.
Well, maybe.
Well,
we
I think his lawyers did advise him not to
testify
without a subpoena.
The way this could all come out in the wash is, you know, if he gets impeached, I believe he'd totally play the martyr card, which is that, you know, I've been impeached
I think that's already happening.
Well, you said he hasn't spoken publicly. I mean, you know, right. if he, how this comes out is that he'll basically say, right. you know, I was impeached for... exposing these inappropriate relationships and this inappropriate influence, and it was totally in the best interest of the university, and, you know, at least it's out there, you know.
Right.
I'll just say quickly, the fourth thing that he might get impeached for is the handling of this letter with information about Jim Pitts' son. And this is also sort of tied, this is also something that might not have happened without the impeachment investigation.
And that's actually federal law, right? You're messing with the records
right,
of the
student.
Right,
he may have violated federal private student privacy laws.
Yeah.
And so basically, a letter about a state representative's son getting into law school, which contained identifiable information about that student who did get into law school, which makes it federally protected. He shared that with his lawyers, and then after being told by the system not to, and then that seems to have gotten, although this is a big inference, there's not direct evidence about this, but that letter seems to have gotten from his lawyers to blogs that were friendly to Hall's cause. So they accuse him of mishandling private student information.
Right. You had so, this. It got out. It must have gotten out from you.
But no, so it's not clear what his aim is. I mean, obviously he wants powers gone. I mean, that's just unambiguous.
And hasn't Perry largely supported him in this impeachment effort?
Yeah. Perry has said that this impeachment effort is sort of an effort to chill regents. And obviously Perry appointed him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of cover things. And that's one of the interesting things about this whole thing is that Perry's just allowed this to go on. Now, I think part of the difficulty with Hall's case that he's doing this all in the best interest of the university is that clearly this has not been good for the university. Right. I mean, just the process. And so you can maybe the light at the end of the tunnel is good.
Well, right. Yeah, I mean, you could make the argument that, you know, short term this is tough, but long term this is for the good of the university.
Right.
I think it's interesting that he hasn't really sort of given his theory of the case.
One of the things that they call him out for in this report, and I think the report is sort of from an unfriendly light.
Right.
But they say that no witness, and they mostly heard from anti-Hall inclined witnesses. No witness could point to a single reform that he's proposed. You know, his most notable reform is that he got this online sort of database of records requests that the university system has received.
Right. So when somebody makes an open records request, the university posts it up on its site, but doesn't post the answers, which is sort of frustrating.
Right. It's sort of – I think it's actually caused more, you know, difficulties over there than it has –
Yeah, it's made some reporters mad, but you know, who cares what reporters
You mentioned whistleblower earlier in terms of other people, the witnesses coming before the committee. Could you see Hall calling himself a whistleblower in any impeachment hearings?
He hasn't blown a whistle yet.
Well, but I mean, if you see him, as you were saying, you know, maybe the speculation that he's going to, you know, when compelled through a subpoena, maybe during an impeachment hearing, to give what his end goal is.
No, but they're not going to subpoena him. They made that clear.
Oh, okay.
Public hearings are more or less over.
So the subpoena itself serves as a legal shield, and so his lawyers are telling him, don't go without a subpoena because that privileges the information and you want it privileged.
Apparently, but you also see this is – and they talk about this in the report. This seems to be sort of a pattern where he sort of gets the wheels of accusation in motion and then sort of doesn't follow through, right? So like if he really wanted to make his case, he could – do that. But he's done a similar thing with, they talk about this, the Attorney General's office. So over a year ago, or about a year ago, they referred an investigation to the Law School Foundation, the Regents did, to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office then said, can each of you tell us what you want us to investigate over there? Because you guys have already investigated it, and you were unsatisfied with the results of your own investigation, so that's why you're asking us to do it. We don't want to waste our time. Tell us what you want us to look into. And Hall has refused to give them a written statement. It's like he won't go on the record with any goals or vision or motivation.
Spanish Inquisition.
So let's.
And maybe he thinks he'll get trashed if he goes on the record, which is probably true.
So and he's not getting trashed not going on the record.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So outside of the nitty gritty details.
Why does this matter?
No, that wasn't what I was going to ask. I think I know why it matters. What I was going to ask is play this out. Is he going to get impeached? Are the votes there? I mean, will they recommend it? Will the House vote on it? What will the Senate do?
So right now, so the the committee has to decide what they want to do. If you look at the committee, you would probably think that they have just enough votes to recommend impeachment, and the way Hall has treated them has angered some of the people that would have been more favorable to him by refusing to show up, by his lawyers sending angry letters accusing the committee of not doing their job, of being politically motivated. So that he's angered people there. I think Dan Flynn, who's a co-chair, who might have been more on the fence about the whole thing, has called Hall's treatment of the committee a slap in the face. So I think he's made no friends at the committee. Some of the people at the committee were already not on his side. And then you have people like, you know, one of the committee members has repeatedly called for the governor to demand his resignation. So I would think that they would have the votes on the committee.
And that makes a recommendation to the House. The House votes to either impeach or not impeach, and then it tries in the Senate.
Right. So they have, timing-wise, they have an interesting
Do they have to timing call the House problem. In if they do that?
Yeah, the Speaker can call the House in if they recommend impeachment, if they get 50 signatures. Which
so they don't have to wait for the regular session?
No. Because there are special rules for impeachment.
Back to Austin.
Go around the governor. But
happy summer.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have like the Michael Quinn Sullivan folks who wield some influence in the House, do not want to see Wallace Hall impeached, and they'll be watching this closely.
This is Empower Texans. And,
yeah. And folks like that.
Right.
You know, so it'll be interesting to see if they can muster the votes. I think the leadership in the House is not a big fit, like, doesn't have, not, Hall does not have many fans in the leadership of the House. So they might have a shot of voting him out. And Hall has been sort of making political donations in political season, which might sort of cast him in a negative light for people that might otherwise have not really cared about the situation.
Hmm.
So it could get out of the House. Now, the Senate is where it sort of gets tricky, and especially if they don't get it done before the November elections, when everyone's either a lame duck and don't care, or you have the new, more conservative Senate coming in.
When is Hall's term up?
2017.
Okay.
So they could just sit on the recommendations until 2016, I guess, and but then this has time to bring them out. But if Hall does get impeached, which is still a long shot, despite all the sort of we've gone through, he will be the third big impeachment in the state's history, the first non-elected official in the state's history. So it could be a very historical figure.
After all this, we've spilled a lot of ink about it.
Yeah. But so we'll see what happens with the report. But so now the grounds for impeachment have been laid out. And that's sort of where we are. And
when are they going to make the report itself public? They've
released it's public. It's public. It's on the House
Reeve tweeted representative it out last night.
Website. But it is interesting, though. It seems like a lot of this just could have been avoided by cooperating with the committee, whether you think that they're on the level or not, I think.
Right.
Well, I guess if you think that the end game is going to be, or the committee is going to come up with an impeachment either way, then why show up?
Well, on the other hand, you know, you can make an argument here that the whole kerfluffle has made public some things
kerfluffle
that he wanted.
Kerfluffle or kerfuffle?
It could be a kerfluffle. You don't know.
Depends on how bad it is.
Yeah. That the whole thing has raised the visibility in a way that he wanted it raised.
Exactly. Hmm. Like I said, murder.
Yeah, but I just think when you scratch the surface of the issues he's raised, they might be concerning, but maybe not quite damning.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
I think darning.
I think
yeah. How
I think
much
for him to play the martyr card going forward, they have to be pretty damning.
Right.
For all of this, he's, you know, there were people that will blame other people, but none of this would have happened without Wallace Hall.
Right.
Right. Other people say that Wallace Hall, sort of other people have been going after Wallace Hall, and that's why we've spent so much money on this investigation, blah, 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 blah. But there are ways that Wallace Hall could have made this better.
Hmm.
But that's not the only committee that's had action this week. There's also a big discussion of open carry over at the Capitol, which came sort of not long after the Fort Hood shooting. Do we think open carry is going to happen in the coming session?
You know, I think it would be hard for a Republican legislature to vote against it. It kind of depends on how it gets framed and how
especially
it,
when
how
Wendy
it comes
Davis
up.
Supports it.
Right. I mean, you know, it kind of depends on how they present it and how it goes through the system. And it also depends on what's in the headlines at the time that they're doing it. I mean, if there's a, you know, some incident that makes that issue more or less attractive, I think they're really, really sensitive to public opinion and public sentiment at the time that they're actually voting. But if it gets to the floor of either house, I think it's very difficult for these guys who've been talking about it this whole time to vote against it. That would be sort of interesting. And I'm sure that both sides would present it to them as a career move, however they vote.
Right. You know, something we learned from our most recent polling center post on this by Jim Henson and Josh Blank is that, you know, in Texas, the dialogue after there are events like Fort Hood is not around gun control. It's around fewer restrictions on guns.
Right. If only someone there had a gun to defend themselves.
Right, exactly. The other thing I actually learned from our story on this that I thought was interesting is that you can already openly carry in Texas hunting rifles and certain kinds of guns. Basically, we're
just not handguns.
Just not
really.
Handguns. Right?
Long rifles are allowed.
And they had that during South by Southwest. They had a demonstration of multiple people with their rifles walking down 6th Street.
Right.
I think that was just a band.
You know, I think when you have, again,
that was just the polyphonic spree. They're doing this whole Civil War
club owners
thing.
Who are really, really cranky.
I think there are a lot of groups that oppose open carry of handguns because they feel like it's, you know, intimidating, potentially dangerous. You know, I think Chuy Hinojosa had a great quote in the story where he said it was open carry was in bad taste and bad manners, which I thought was funny. But, you know, when you have, again, Wendy Davis making a lot of headlines for saying she's not, you know, opposed to the open carrying of handguns, you know.
Well, I think it'd just be interesting to see what kind of restrictions they put on. I mean, you know, Davis's kind of qualifier for all this, and other people as well have been.
As long as everyone with handguns gets paid equally, it's fine.
Yeah. Right. No, as long as... If Emily came in with a handgun, I'd pay her equal.
Yes,
you know,
seriously.
I hope
that's not what it takes, Ben.
I mean, to be honest, that's been some of the debate around open carry, around concealed carry on college campuses. Is that, you know, if students, if you know your student is packing heat, you know,
are you less likely to give him a D on the paper?
Let's talk about grade inflation here, right?
Exactly.
But Wendy Davis is only if the private business allows it, only if the college campus allows. I mean, it allows open carry,
so she's for open carry where it's allowed.
Please leave gun at door, so there's a gun check room.
That would be interesting. I think that's going to be the most interesting part of the legislation is, will it allow a city like Austin to say thanks but no thanks, or will it tell the city of Austin you have to do it?
Local control, that's what you're saying.
Here's Republicans love local control unless it affects, I mean, anybody,
here he goes.
Politicians in general. I mean, well, you had talk about local control, and yet you've got vetoes of local option gas taxes for TxDOT.
Right.
I mean, there have been multiple instances of, you know, just politics in general of, you know, everything's local control unless, of course, we have an overarching theme we want to force everyone to do.
I will say someone from the National Rifle Association testified, and this sort of struck me as wrong, but he basically said that, look, we're not talking about a big change here. You know, people are already carrying guns. We're just saying that a different way to carry them. It's a slight tweak. And it seems like the difference between carrying something concealed and openly carrying a handgun seems like a big change.
Yeah, it's not a slight tweak.
Well, you might argue that if someone's carrying it openly, at least you know.
Yeah, actually, this came up in the debate over the concealed handgun law.
Well,
yeah. when they did this the first time, this came up in the debate and said, wouldn't it be, you know, more of a deterrent to criminal or bad activity if they could see that you had a gun? They wouldn't do
isn't the other argument to that when you walk into a room and you see the one person with a gun, you just shoot them first? I mean,
so
the Alabama way,
right?
Now we know Philpott's strategy.
It seems to me like the bigger debate is around carrying or not carrying, not whether you conceal it or it's not concealed.
Well, I think the argument here is that the open or closed is really just a nuance.
I think concealment or not concealment is a big difference. Because openly carrying a gun seems like a more aggressive posture to take just if you're walking around among a group of people than quietly carrying a gun.
It's like not being
able to tell which snakes are poisonous or something. Right?
It would certainly help me to know
which would make me much more comfortable if I fall into a bed of snakes.
Well, I mean, think about being on the House floor. I would certainly feel more comfortable with my seat selection if I knew which of those lawmakers were carrying guns.
Right.
Not the most trustworthy bunch.
I'm just going to stick to long rifles myself.
Yeah, right, exactly. Just don't carry rifles that are from like the 1880s, right?
Right.
Those are still illegal.
Right.
So are we handicapping open carry as a likely passage for the session?
Well, if it gets to the floor.
If they let it get to the floor of either house, I think it'll pass. But I think that's a huge if. I mean, that's what...
Yeah.
That's what the legislative process is all about. Does this get hung in committee? Does it get hung in calendars? Does the new lieutenant governor, whoever that is,
say, or does it get Dan shot down? Because we're well, more than that now.
Good. Somebody had to do
good
that.
Shot down. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
Okay, you have to do the rest of the podcast by yourself.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel that way. Actually, you probably do feel that way sometimes, Ross.
Like when I'm checking my phone in the podcast, which I'm not doing today or last week. Just need to shout that out.
This is kind of like a therapy session all of a sudden. Speaking of therapy sessions, let's talk about the sort of big gathering to revitalize Lyndon B. Johnson's career and legacy.
You just compared the Civil Rights Summit to a therapy session.
That's pretty good, actually. Yeah.
So, Ben, it's happening in your backyard. What is the deal?
What about our backyard?
It's closer to Ben's backyard.
It is closer to my backyard.
You know, Ben lives in, like, you know, San Antonio.
No. Where he works. He works... His office the is over on the UT campus.
I know. He works at the same institute over with Wallace Hall.
Actually, that's true.
I got to tell you, when he came in and bullied me, it was horrible. He got left out of the report.
But also,
I don't know what happened.
He exposed some serious problems with you that I think we're all glad to know.
Look.
And we're happy they're out in the light.
I've started washing my lunch dishes, okay? Let's get over it.
Can you just tell us what the Civil Rights Summit is?
Well, I guess that kind of depends on what you want to say about it. It's a beginning to a celebration of the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act, which was signed actually was it June or July of 64. So we're not quite there yet. But this is the big bang start to it. They've got four presidents coming in.
Everyone but H.W. Bush.
All the living presidents other than H.W. Bush. And they opened the conference yesterday with a letter from him. So all the presidents have been represented. But, yeah, it is the rehabilitation of his presidency in another light from the idea of the broken man from the Vietnam War who stepped down instead of, you know, going into battle against Kennedy. For the next presidential nomination, to a person who, I guess the quote from the Don Gagne story on NPR this morning was, the most important civil rights president since Lincoln. Mm-hmm. And you can definitely, when you look at a lot of the different social service bills and civil rights bills, the act obviously that got passed, you can start to make that argument. But of course, at the end of his presidency, all everybody knew was Vietnam and the broken man that stepped down.
And in that same piece this morning, that Don was saying that, you know, for years at Democratic nominating conventions, you know, nobody would even mention Johnson's name because his legacy was so tarnished by Vietnam.
Yep. Including Bill Clinton in 1992, who will be speaking at the summit tonight.
You know, it's really fascinating. I'm curious. Who makes the decision that we're going to try to, you know, reinvent someone's legacy?
Oh, I think the presidential library. I mean, I think you could make an argument that that's all the presidential library is there for.
Right.
I mean,
and some people at the LBJ library might disagree that is the primary motivation of this summit.
I don't know. I mean, Mark Updegrove, who's the director of the library, basically said, you know, this is someone whose legacy has been, you know, whose huge civil rights legacy has been completely overshadowed. I think they're very, you know, forthcoming about the fact that the purpose of this is part of a sort of bigger initiative.
And also to celebrate the signing of the act.
To celebrate the signing of the act, but also to reimagine his legacy.
But it does seem to be working, right? So in addition to the Don Gagne piece, Karen Tumulty at the Washington Post wrote a column about it this morning and said, you know, this is good. It's good to reconsider Johnson. Look at all he did. I was speaking with Graham Nash from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young yesterday, and he was like, all I really knew about Johnson was Vietnam, and we shouldn't think about him that way. And here's this guy that wrote all these, you know, sung all these songs sort of protesting the Vietnam War. And he's like, well, that's not what we should think of when we think of LBJ.
And they have the phone records of him, you know, talking to Martin Luther King that was really compelling this morning that I'd actually, you know, never heard. I mean, I confess to being one of these people who sort of grew up thinking of knowing a particular legacy about Johnson. The library has been very beneficial in that regard because it's fascinating.
The LBJ phone records are just amazing. I've had a chance to listen to several of them.
There's a terrific Michael Beschloss book, and if you get the audio version, I don't have it in front of me, I don't remember the name of it, but if you get the audio version of it, it's about Johnson's phone conversations and about his tapes, and they go through all these tapes, and you're basically listening to Beschloss introduce telephone conversations and tapes of Johnson, and he's just masterful on the phone. I mean, whether you're with him or against him, it's just like, this guy's a piece of work.
Well, he was also... incredibly masterful in getting things done and sort of getting his way, which is something we really haven't seen in a president this millennium. Maybe.
Right. He's the bully from the bully pulpit.
Medicare. But one of the things Beschloss said, you know, is that you can't overstate how big his fumbles were with Vietnam. You know, they were huge, huge fumbles. But at the same time, he was incredibly masterful at getting these other, you know, things accomplished.
I think one of the interesting things about the summit is that the premier Johnson biographer is not invited or present. Robert Caro is not there.
He just came down for South by Southwest EDU, so it's not like he's not traveling to Austin.
Right, and you know he spends a lot of time. He's probably spent more time at the library than anybody who's not an employee there. And his book, his fourth book in what was originally a trilogy, I guess it's now going to be a five-book series, was really about...
It's like Star Wars.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Disney's buying the book?
Yeah, the Wookiees are in the next one, or those Ewok things. The fourth book was largely about what happened right after Kennedy was killed and Johnson became president and passing all of these bills in 1964. And this sort of, you know, in a narrative sense, kind of started the wave that this conference is on.
And they don't have care. They do have Robert Shankin was there yesterday, who's the Pulitzer Prize winning playwright who wrote All the Way, which is on Broadway right now, which is about sort of getting the Civil Rights Act passed with Bryan Cranston. It's supposed to be great.
Right. Beschloss is there. Updegrove himself.
Mavis Staples.
I don't think she wrote a biography, but.
No, but she sang some great songs. Not about LBJ necessarily, but. Are we just listing people?
I do think it was interesting the way they opened the summit was not a look back, but a look at where the Civil Rights Act is being maybe used in today's politics and today's legal system. With the first two panels were gay rights and immigrant rights, essentially. And so I just think it's very interesting. It's kind of like reminding everybody, look, this was something that was focused very specifically, or at least appeared very specifically on the segregated South, on blacks in general in the United States. But we're trying to show you that it's an umbrella that's covering these new areas that are very, hot topics in society right now.
Well, and there seems to be an acceptance at the summit that gay rights is definitely one of the big civil rights issues of our day. That's not really been challenged. I think it might be challenged at other summits, but it seems to be at this LBJ Library Section Summit, it seems to be very much like, yes, this is a big deal and we need to be talking about this. Also talked about women's rights and immigration. Rodney Ellis, state senator, was there, said public education is sort of the big civil rights issue of the day, and he hopes to get increased education funding in the next session, although he said that might be more up to the courts than the coming legislature.
Well, and do you think it's a coincidence that the Obama administration has really made this week about, women's issues? This is sort of Equal Pay Week, which, by the way, worked out perfectly for the Wendy Davis campaign, that they've been beating the drum on this for, the last month, and it just so happens that now it's the Obama administration's turn.
Well, I think in honor of that, we'll give Emily the last word there, since we're out of time.
Since you don't pay her as much.
Yeah,
I was going to say,
in lieu of pay.
I deserve the last word. How much cash does that last word come with?
About 23 cents. On behalf of
Ross. Give me a stamp.
Ben, I think that gets you half a stamp these days. When was the last time you mailed a letter?
I don't know. I only get forever stamps.
Emily, our producer Todd, we'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music. And please send all your complaints to tribcast@texastribune.org. Come see us in Austin at Schultz Garden on the 23rd. You can get tickets at slate.com/Austin. Until then, I'm Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Texas talking about Texas talking, baby. Texas talking, baby.
I'm just Jenny from the block.
I'm still Jenny from the block.